from KUER News in Salt Lake City. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The questions found in the story of Job in the Bible are the toughest questions there are if you're a believer. You remember the story. God allows Satan to test Job, a pious and good man, to see if he'll remain loyal. So he's afflicted with all kinds of misery. The big question, of course, is why does God allow suffering? And not just that, but why do the wicked sometimes triumph and the innocent suffer? Why would anyone want to believe in that God? What interests the scholar Mark Larimore about the book is how different people interpret the story. Because it's not just believers who find meaning in Job. In fact, he says, for atheists, it's their favorite book in the Bible. Today in the program, Larimore is joining us to talk about the book of Job and what it tells us about the people who have used it over the years. Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we invite you to put $10 in our tip jar. Text KUER to 85944 to make that donation. Thank you.
This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. It's not just believers who try and make sense of the book of Job and the Old Testament. The religion scholar Mark Larimore says atheists often find it their favorite book in the Bible. And the reason is obvious. It's a story that has God getting suckered into a wager with Satan to mess with this pious and good man named Job. God lets Satan strip Job of pretty much everything but his life, his children, his possessions, his health, his identity. And in this sense, Larimore says it's often seen as monotheism's admission of moral bankruptcy. But of course, Job does win the bet for God. He does stay faithful. And so if you believe in a divine creator who has some system of justice, you can also find meaning in the story, though take some work. This is what interests Larimore about the book, by the way different people have read it over the years, or as he puts it, the history of its use. Today in the program, Mark Larimore is joining us to talk about his book. It's called The Book of Job, a Biography. And we invite you to join the conversation. If you have comments or questions, 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Mark Larimore directs Eugene Lang College's Religious Studies program at the New School for Liberal Arts in New York City. He's also the editor of The Problem of Evil, a Reader. And he's joining us from a studio in New York City this morning. And Mark Larimore, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure. Nice to meet you, Doug.
So I guess I wanted to start with this experience I had read about that you had in high school, your first experience with the Book of Job. You were in Archibald MacLeish's play, J.B., which is about Job. Yeah. Is that what got you first thinking about this story?
I suppose so. My role in it was not a big role. I had three small roles. I was Messenger 2, Messenger 2, and Messenger 2. So I got to be part of a team of actors, young high school actors, who came in and brought the horrible news that Job's various kids had been killed in horrible ways. And other people, including people I admired, got to be God and Satan and all the other – and Job.
Yeah.
So maybe, you know, I'd been waiting for a while to – Get my say in on what it was about.
Yeah. Were you thinking about what it was about though in those days, or was it just a high school play?
I know I was thinking about it later. It's sort of a blur, but maybe that means I was thinking about it a lot, or maybe I was just very jealous of the character who got to play God.
Well, it does happen. You came to teach a seminar about Job, and I wanted to ask you about that. So obviously this is rattling around in your mind. You're trying to get at some of these – I mean, what was it about the story that you eventually came to, you wanted to teach about and eventually write about?
Well, as you already said in the introduction, a lot of really, really interesting people have sort of cut their teeth on Job. The Book of Job somehow provides material for widely different views, and it gets people thinking really hard and really creatively. And they're doing really interesting and important work sort of at a theory level. Mm-hmm. But also the Book of Job is so important in the lives of many religious people and also some non-religious people.
So you're less interested really in dealing with the questions in the Book of Job, although that you do talk about that, but you're really interested in the way people interpret the story, at least initially. That's the way in, I guess.
Yes, that's the way in. So, I mean, I did do a lot of work before that on the problem of theodicy, which I guess you've covered in this program before.
Yeah.
And the Book of Job kept coming up, So I put together that anthology a few years ago and was thinking, well, I should put in part of the Book of Job, but which part? And I couldn't decide. There was no part that I felt that comfortable leaving out, including the bits most people hate. So finally in the introduction, I said, before you read this book, there's a few things you should read, and one of them is the Book of Job.
Right.
So that was kind of, I don't know. And then I had to sort of deliver on that promise and had the chance to teach the seminar and found that it was actually a marvelous way of doing sort of a history of religion and also an investigation of these terribly difficult, important questions.
Do you think this is the thing that people, they talk about Job, they talk about the story, they talk about the patience of Job, or they get to the moral of the story or whatever, but they don't really know how it plays out in the actual Bible?
Yeah, I think an awful lot of people know exactly what happens in the Book of Job without ever having read it.
Yeah.
But of course, that's true of the Bible as a whole.
Yeah. Here's one thing that you've said that I wanted to ask you about. You've said that you've come to all of this. You do not come to the Book of Job, you say, out of suffering of your own. And the Book of Job demands of me that I admit this. What do you mean?
Thank you for the question. It's actually really, really important to me that there's a lot of talking, a lot of writing about trauma, about suffering, especially sort of in the aftermath of the 20th century and into the 21st. That doesn't look to be very much better. And there are a great many people who've been silenced, many people who've died, many people who've lost their voices, and others who've tried to speak for them. And sometimes that speaking for them has been a good thing, but very often it has taken the place of these people's voices. Mm. And I feel very keenly that I have a responsibility to draw attention to those voices rather than to displace them. I think the Book of Job is really one of its message, and who knows what its moral is, but one of its morals certainly is that Job's friends who try to speak for him get it wrong.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting. You give the friends a break, though. You don't think they're as inept as everyone seems to think they are. Maybe we can talk about that a little bit later, but I do think it's interesting the way you look at the friends, even though they got it wrong.
I think mine's probably the only book on the Book of Job that has a picture of the friends on the cover.
Yeah.
Rather than a picture of Job or a picture of Job's children being killed or of God.
Why is that?
Part of it is that I come at this as a friend. I mean, as I mentioned before, yeah, there's kind of a sense that there are people who are in great existential, physical, social, other distress, and I'm not one of them. I don't hope to be one of them. I might be. You never know. But I do feel that their voices need to be heard. I wish to be a friend to them, perhaps by being with them and encouraging them to speak and encouraging others to listen to them. But also because I think that when it comes to the Book of Job, the real temptation for readers is to come in and tell – and a lot of people tell me this. Oh, let me tell you what the Book of Job is about. So I listen patiently. I usually learn something. But they usually tell us what they think that God should have said. So they don't just take the place of the friends. They don't just take the place of Job. They actually take the place of God. And that seems like something probably none of us should be doing.
Yeah. What do you mean you learn something? Because it's interesting, and we'll get to this as we go, but it seems like you can learn some important things about people, about the way they interpret the story, I guess.
Absolutely. And yes, every time that I've been part of a discussion about the Book of Job, somebody has said something that I've never heard before that sort of stuns me with its perceptiveness. And very often it's not a scholar, it's not a religious figure, it's not somebody who spent a lot of time studying it, but it's somebody who has lived with Job. I could give an example that recently I went to a performance of a sort of an excerpted version of the Book of Job in Red Hook, which is a part of Brooklyn that was affected by Hurricane Sandy.
Yeah.
And after the performance, a number of people who had been there on the front lines came and spoke about how this story of Job spoke to them. And one of them was a policeman. And he said, I'm ashamed to say, a policeman from Far Rockaway, whose house had been destroyed in the storm. And he said, I'm ashamed to say that I was Job during this story. And he repeated that. He said, no, I'm ashamed to say that I was speaking the way Job was. And I had never heard anybody talk about Job as anything but an honorable, heroic person. So the sense somehow or other that there would be something shameful about sounding like Job was one that it took me several days to try and understand. I asked everybody I knew who might be able to explain it to me. But I had no doubt as I was hearing it that this was a legitimate insight into the text, one that I had not yet encountered.
Really? Not just a misreading of it, that he thought that Job had cursed God or something?
I think it might be that. The understanding that I sort of came to with my friends was the sense that he, as somebody who was in the helping professions, had always felt that he was, you know, God's helper. He was the person who was helping other people who were in distress. He had never imagined himself being the helpless one.
Wow.
And somehow or other, and this was interesting, he had never really thought about what it was to be the helpless person receiving his own help from this person. And so it's not just that he was ashamed of it, but he had actually come to this gathering in order to share this with people.
Gosh.
And if you can tell me more about what he meant. The strange thing is, I guess I mention it because I didn't think as he said it, I've never heard this before, this doesn't make sense to me, but rather, this doesn't make sense to me yet, but it sounds not just heartfelt, but somehow or other, it sounds right.
Yeah.
In ways I don't yet grasp.
But isn't that the essence of the story for a lot of people, that it doesn't make sense to them yet?
Yes. So somebody who told me what the Book of Job was about recently said the whole point is that, you know, in the end, everything makes sense and we should just wait, as Job did, because God may take his time, but he always comes. He's always on time. And even if it was as a person breathes their last breath, when God will appear to them at that point, then every question will be answered. And all we're called to do is wait until that moment, presumably breathing.
But what moment? I mean, what does he mean? Because God doesn't give him an answer. It doesn't seem – I mean, he does get his property back. He gets some more beautiful daughters than the kids he had before. Some of that was sort of resolved. But we'll work through all this as we go. But God doesn't give him any answers. God doesn't really tie it up very cleanly. He says, you shouldn't be asking. I'm God. I know what I'm doing. So there isn't really a resolution to it. So what does it mean? What did that person mean? Again, are they just misunderstanding it, or they're just trying to sort of get whatever sort of meaning they can from a story that's pretty confusing?
Well, I think in the case of this person, I think it was a story that she'd grown up with. Yeah. So like many people who encounter biblical figures, they're sort of part of folklore, part of sort of Bible stories that you read in Bible books as a kid, things that you hear about in various ways. And then you either come to the text and sort of just gloss over the bits that don't make sense, or you never actually come to the text. So I think she was speaking out of that tradition, sort of an oral tradition, which in the book I try and suggest goes all the way back. It might even be older than the text that we have, a very pious story, which says, oh, well, you know, if the good, if they suffer, if they just wait long enough, they will be rewarded in double. But you mentioned a really, really important fact, I think, about the Book of Job, which is that Job does not get his questions answered.
No. Well, we're going to come back to that.
He gets a big speech from God and then another big speech from God.
Yeah.
But one of the weird things, I mean, if you look at the Book of Job as a work of literature or something, like, we know as readers that that's not why Job is suffering.
Yeah.
It was because of the wager with Satan. And that's not what God talks about either.
No. And he doesn't get to that either. He doesn't want to be questioned on why he's messing with Job. He just... Yeah, let me back up. You mentioned that in some ways it's possible that originally people – that this story was more often heard than it was read, that it was an oral tradition. But the point is, I guess, that we're not really sure about where this comes from, this story.
That's right. I mean, I'm not a Bible scholar is my main training. I work mainly on modern stuff and the way we try to make sense of things today.
Yeah.
But to the best of my ability, hanging out with Bible scholars and reading their work and efforts to trace the Book of Job back to a single author or a single time or even a single language have all – it's been very difficult to do so. We don't really know. There are lots of different conjectures about it, but we don't know. And the one thing that we think we do know is that it wasn't just one person.
Right.
It seems to be in different parts that don't fit together very well. So we know that there were various people along the way. We don't know who the first one was. We don't know how many earlier versions there were before the one that finds its way to us today.
And you say Job stands – you've said – put it this way. He stands outside of the history. We don't think Job was Jewish necessarily. We don't think it was necessarily even written by Jews. And in that sense, you say it makes Job a quintessentially modern figure.
Yes, I think that. I think that he's described as the greatest man of the East. And there's no genealogy attached. The Septuagint version does give him a genealogy and sort of slots him into the history of the people of Israel. But the Masoretic text and the text that Christians now use doesn't do that. So Job is sort of floating off on his side. He's no relation to any of the people we hear about otherwise in the Old Testament, in the Hebrew Bible. And there's no suggestion that he's going to join those people. He doesn't know about the Noahide laws. He doesn't know about what happened on Sinai. He wasn't part – I mean, none of these things are part of his story. He's off doing his own thing and seems to have his own relationship with God. And that way, I think he's a little bit like people nowadays who somehow or other come to some kind of an understanding of the universe. And there may be religious traditions that may believe in covenants of other things, but that's not even the way they access it. Or maybe they were part of one of those traditions and have found themselves alienated from it, but still think that they've got some kind of an understanding of and relationship with whatever they take to be divine.
He's a really relatable figure, you've said. This is a figure we can all kind of connect to in some way, I guess.
Yes, although I have to say over the course of writing this book, there are times when I found it harder than times when I found it easier.
Yeah. What were the harder times?
The harder bits were I was reading an essay by an evangelical scholar named David Clines, which is probably my favorite essay on the Book of Job. It's called "Why Is There a Book of Job and What Does It Do to You When You Read It?" And it says, so in order for a book like this to have made it to us, somebody must have written it down, and somebody must have paid for somebody else to make a copy, and another copy, and another copy, and another copy, because texts from that period very rarely survive. So who would have been interested enough to pay somebody to write this book and then to rewrite it? And then he's in the midst of writing a vast commentary on the Book of Job, says it's a supremely literary text. It's full of words that nobody even at that point would have understood. Mm-hmm. It was clearly a product, he says, or it looks like it's a product for elite delectation. You'd sort of enjoy the language of it and its complexity. And then the bit that really got me was his argument that the only sort of person who would believe the story of Job would be a rich person, that it's really the story, it's sort of the death wish dream of a rich person who wonders, if everything were taken away from me, would I survive?
Yeah. Wow, that's interesting. I wanted to go through some of the basics of the story. So as you mentioned, Job is this man in a land of, is it Uz?
Uz, I guess
is the good way to put
yes.
it. Yeah. Is there such a place?
Maybe. Yeah. There were various theories along the way about where it was. So it's not just a modern thing to say we don't know where Job came from. But Jewish and Christian interpreters always started out by saying, well, so where is this man and where does he come from? And we've got to fit him in somewhere.
Yeah.
And so there were various theories that were based on sort of more or less strained etymologies and connections to various figures in the Old Testament. But in fact, nobody could quite place him. They really knew where he was. But I've been told of at least three graves of Uz,
wow,
of Job, in different parts of Arabia. I think there's one in Oman and one somewhere in Syria, I believe.
And the point is, he was a man who was, as it says, perfect and upright. And we know he was prosperous. 10 children, thousands of camels and sheep and servants, richest man in the East, I guess. And that's the sort of the setup. We know he's not just a prosperous and a powerful man, but he's a good man. He fears God. That's important to the story too, of course.
Yes.
But then, and this is an interesting point. So there's the role of Satan in this story, or this, it's a Satan-like figure. It's not the Satan that most sort of Christians know of, I don't think. But even though that is the term, and I wanted you to point out, he's kind of this prosecuting attorney.
Yeah.
And it's almost like this is a court. This is a trial going on in court in some way. Give us a sense of that, of the setting here for this story.
Yeah, the start is monstrously difficult for people working with any kind of orthodox view, because it suggests that, you know, one day the sons of God were in front of you. Sons of God? sons, plural, God? So this, again, it seems to be taking place in some different religious universe than most of the rest of the Bible that we know. But so there's this divine court, and then there's this character called the Satan, who is the prosecuting attorney, or the, I don't know, somebody who goes out, the quality checker, maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know. And he sort of comes in, and then God says, what have you been doing? He says, oh, I've been checking your creation. I've been going, you know, up and down on the earth. And then God points Job out to him and said, have you looked at this guy? He's the best there is. So not only is there a wager between God and Satan about whether they can destroy Job's piety, but the wager is initiated by God.
Yeah. Do you find that? I find that so interesting. Why is it that God points Job out to the Satan? I think there's got to be something powerful in that.
Mm-hmm. The sort of the standard reading, in Gregory the Great, so from the 4th century of the Common Era on for a long time in Christian readings, was that by this time the Satan had become Satan, and God was in this existential struggle with Satan. And Satan was very strong enough that he could break almost all people, but he couldn't break Job. And so God points Job out to Satan because God knows in his omnipotence and omniscience that Job is the only one, perhaps, who can resist all of Satan's efforts to destroy him, and that Satan will be humiliated and ultimately destroyed by his failure in this wager. So that's why God would then call out Job. And then from Gregory's point of view, why, if God calls you out, you should feel flattered? Because God wouldn't be sending you a test that you couldn't pass. And so if God is opening you to the afflictions from Satan, it must be that God thinks that you are more powerful than Satan, one of those few people who can actually resist the wiles of the tempter.
But what's the other way?
Does that help?
Well, no.
Right.
isn't that the point? I mean, and I guess the idea is also, so if this is where early Christians, this is the sort of the resolution they came to. But this is an important part of your book, though, because you point out that how people read these texts. You say in your book that many of us assume, for example, that the Book of Job is this this affixed text, has a beginning and a middle and an end, but you say that really limits our reading of that story. So this is the point, I suppose, is that maybe we're not reading it correctly. Maybe we're reading it in a different way. We're trying to sort of pigeonhole it into our own idea, into our own concept.
Yeah, and I guess once the Book of Job gets hold of you, and it's hard approaching it not to be drawn by it and not to feel that this really is about the really important questions, it won't let go of you.
Yeah.
And then what it demands of you as a reader or somebody who's telling the story or enacting it in some ways, you have to find some way to make it make sense. And at one point I suggested the Book of Job is a bit like a mousetrap that way. It sort of tempts people to come in and say, I know what's going on. I actually can understand the nature of the human situation. I know why suffering happens. I know why the just suffer and the unjust prosper. It makes perfect sense to me. And then the Book of Job, there's always bits of it that, you know, elude any particular interpretation.
Right. In short order, he pretty much loses everything. All 10 of his children are killed at once. And then you mentioned there's this moment, which I have to say, there's a lot of this story which is, I don't know if beautiful is the right word, but there is some beauty in the kind of anguish that's going on. And three friends of Job come on this scene, as you point out, and they hardly recognize Job. It's like he's mm-hmm. lost his, what, like he's lost his identity in some way?
Yes. So not only is his house gone and his clothes gone, but his skin is covered with pustulent sores. To me, that's a very, very important moment.
Yeah.
In fact, that's the moment that I chose for the that was an image of that I chose for the cover of the book, where the friends know that Job is in distress, come to find him, but they don't realize it's him.
Right.
Because that wreck of a human being over there couldn't be their friend Job. The moment at which they realize that he is and then start to tear their clothes and shave their heads and cry and weep and stuff, and then they spend 7 days in silence with him, must have been an additional trial for Job, seeing in their eyes how diminished he had become, how unrecognizable he had become, discontinuous with the person he was before.
7 days. They sit with him for 7 days in silence, which, I don't know, I find that just this sort of beautiful reference. I'm trying to imagine it, and it's kind of poignant. You know, it's kind of touching, this idea of them just sitting there working out what to make of all of this, trying to I find that kind of a powerful section.
Yeah, it's one of the reasons I feel the friends get short shrift and we sort of lose important things by saying, oh, well, they're false friends who just came along there to sort of point their fingers at Job. In fact, the story is much more dramatic and much more wrenching because they didn't come to point fingers at Job. They wind up pointing their fingers at Job. But they show up to be with him, to grieve with him. And 7 days in silence, I mean, all the numbers here are, you know, significant numbers, but completeness. Seven is like about a perfect amount of time, a complete amount of time. They don't say a word until he speaks.
Yeah. And finally he does. And you say it's here that the prose in the story moves to poetry.
Yes. And in fact, the whole dialogue section, which takes up most of the Book of Job, 80-some percent of the Book of Job, is speeches. It's almost a dialogue. Some of the interpreters I look at try to read it as a dialogue. Other people see it just as a bunch of speeches that sort of pass like ships in the night or just ignore each other completely. But these are written with extraordinary poetic power, very, very differently from the way in which the frame story is narrated, which is in prose and feels – a number of us scholars sort of call it like the folk tale thing. So it's very homey. It's still got these sort of significant numbers, sevens and tens and stuff like that, sevens and threes and tens and stuff. But it feels so disjunctive that many scholars now just assume without even going beyond, without even checking it, that obviously this is from a different person, from a different author. And so we can't use the frame story to help us understand what happens in the poetic dialogue or vice versa, that they're really two separate texts that have somehow been jammed together into one book.
And then God speaks. He comes in.
Well, actually, a fourth friend shows up.
Yeah, Elihu? Yeah.
Yes. The fourth friend who was not announced, and we don't really know when he showed up because we were told that Job's three friends came along, and then suddenly Elihu speaks and you say, oh, have you been there the whole time? Who invited you? And he's clearly younger than the other friends, and we don't even know that we don't even know who he is, but he scoops a lot of the things God's going to say. And Thomas Aquinas at least thought that he so annoyed God that he was the one who actually provoked a reaction from God, that nothing Job had said had been successful in getting God to speak, but somehow Elihu's nerve in coming forward and saying, all of you people are wrong. Let me tell you what it is that God would tell you if he were going to speak.
Yeah.
That this is what actually provokes God to speak.
Yeah, and then he comes in the whirlwind to say...
Yes.
To
yes.
say what? Because this these divine speeches, this is another critical part of the story. I think if you're a believer, it's or not, it's kind of unsatisfying in some way because God is sort of... is bragging, but he's not providing much in the way of comfort and not providing anything in the way of perspective or context, it seems.
He's certainly not engaging any of the questions that Job's been
right.
asking. Not
right.
only does he not talk about Job's case or about the justice and injustice of human life, he doesn't talk about human beings at all. He talks about all his other creations, all these other fish he's frying.
Yeah, yeah. The horse, the grasshopper, the...
The ostrich.
The ostrich. Yes. Right, right, right.
But I mean, but it's interesting, some of the most... interesting sort of medieval Jewish readings say the whole point of God's speech is that he doesn't talk about human beings, but he's addressing it to a human being. And so in so doing, God presents himself in his utter transcendence to a human being without lowering himself to the level of pretending that human categories can describe what it is that God does.
Right.
So God uses human language but doesn't talk about human things. That way, somehow or other, it provides a bridge to something that's otherwise entirely inaccessible to human beings.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting, too, is you've written about that there's even this idea that the book of Job is sort of written as a parody, a parody of this idea of how we conceive of suffering, I suppose.
I'm very tempted by that reading myself. It's from a scholar in California named Bruce Zuckerman, who says that once it seems that we have this question, so why do we have these two books that are these two different stories, the pious folktale and the angry, beautiful, literary, speechifying sort of jammed into the same book? Which one came first? And what's the relationship between them? And he suggests that, well, there was this oral story, the story about if you suffer in patience, if you wait long enough, God will come through. God is always on time. And somebody was sick to death of hearing that story. Somebody of great literary passion, perhaps great religious insight or something, said, you know, this just won't do. This is terrible. The story that we're telling people, it's an offense. It's shallow. It's whatever. And so wrote this extraordinary parody of it, framed it in terms of what seems like one of these familiar stories, but then was designed for the speeches and the anger and the protest and the mismatch and the fact that people talk past each other and the fact that God doesn't address Job's questions, that all of those things were part of the parody. That it emerged as a parody of a pious tale. And then it was such a popular story that the priests, who must have hated it, tried to suppress it but couldn't. And the next best thing to do was to claim it. So it's a wonderful story. It's an answer to that unanswerable question, how it is that this story emerged and how it found its way into the canon of Scripture, which I find quite tempting myself. That it's I can see that this sort of a story would have been written as parody, in some ways out of anger and indignation at the – I don't know, the complacency with which we talk about other people's suffering. Mm. And that then it would have been so – that its truth or its force would have been so compelling to people that it was beyond the control of the religious authorities who said, no, that's not the way you should be looking at things at all. And so next best thing is claim it and try and give it a religious meaning.
Yeah. Mark Larimore is with us. His book is called The Book of Job, A Biography. I'm way past the time to take a break, Mark Larimore, so we need to. 801-585-WEST, by the way, is the number to join us if you like. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are talking about the Book of Job in the Bible. The scholar Mark Larimore has written what he calls a biography of the book. It's a baffling story in many ways because it raises the most complicated questions. Why does God allow suffering? Why would God mess around with Job like that? Why should anyone be faithful to such a God? But the answers the book provides aren't terribly satisfying. They're not really answers in many ways, so maybe we're reading it wrong. Mark Larimore is joining us to talk about his book, The Book of Job, A Biography, and he's joining us from a studio in New York City. I wonder, one of the things you've talked about is the different ways, different cultures, different people sort of over different times have read this story. Let's talk a little bit more about the Christian reading of it. You mentioned Pope Gregory. Talk a little bit about this, because you say that Christians in some way saw the Job figure as this sort of figuration of Christ.
Yes. In fact, as I was mentioning Gregory the Great before, I said I should really mention that Gregory thought that Job was really just sort of a billboard for Christ.
Yeah.
That those things that Christ goes on to experience are already prefigured in the book of Job. And in fact, what Gregory does is painstakingly going through every word of every phrase is to tell us everything that seems to be about Job is really about Christ. Certainly there was a very strong reading among Christians, it continues into our own time, that sees Job as a Christ figure and as in some ways having known that. So it's a little bit weird because on the one hand, you want to say Job suffered what Christ suffered. And on the other hand, you want to say Job knew that Christ would come when he said, I know that my Redeemer lives. It's a little complicated.
Yeah, it is a little complicated. St. Thomas Aquinas, what was his reading on the story?
Aquinas believed that Job was the only one of his time who knew about the immortality of the soul. And so he has this astonishing reading where he says, Job's friends, being typical Old Testament folk, hadn't heard about immortality yet because Christ hadn't come. But Job somehow knew about this as a prophet. And Job should have realized that the things that he would say that make sense if there's another life would scandalize his friends. And therefore, although what the friends said was wrong, they were trying the best they could with the limited knowledge they had at their disposal, while Job should have known better than to provoke them. It's a very strange reading.
I like the watercolors of William Blake. He did some drawings about certain biblical things. I know Book of Revelation, that's some really interesting images too. But he also did some drawings, some illustrations for the Book of Job. What was William Blake's sort of take on the story as expressed through the imagery?
That was one of the sections that I had the hardest time writing, partly because my claim about it is that the Book of Job, well, there's this key line when God speaks to Job and then Job responds and then he says, I've heard of you with the hearing of the ear, but now my eyes see you.
Yeah.
And that's the moment at which Job arrives, wherever he arrives, at consolation, at a sense of a restored relationship, at understanding, whatever. But it does suggest somehow or other that hearing of the ear words aren't going to be enough in order to explain what this story is about. Something about my eyes see you, something about the visual is necessary in order to explain the kinds of things that the Book of Job tries to suggest are out there. And so I use that as a frame for thinking about Blake, but then I have to write about it in words or now talk about it in words. So it's a little difficult. Dodging your question.
No, you're not. I mean, it's a perfectly good answer. I think what we probably should do is find some of the imagery and put it on our website as a link. I mean, I think it adds another kind of layer to the story, which is, I find that pretty interesting. But it sort of gets also to me, sort of moves us to the point where sort of Job confesses or he recants, talking about how
right.
I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes. Do you think that was part of the original story?
Well, that's one of those passages which, even if I were the Hebraist that I'm not, I would have to say we don't know what it means, that the words are so snarled and tangled at that point that understanding what they mean requires a major confident act of intervention into the text. So what we all hear from the King James Version about I repent in dust and ashes, I abhor myself, is one way of doing that. But there are very few contemporary versions, editions of the Bible that you'll find that say anything like that. He doesn't say abhor himself. Some of them actually finds comfort in dust and ashes, but nobody really knows what it is. And this is the climatic moment. This is where Job gets to where he's supposed to get to. So every interpreter they use everything else they think they know about what the story is, what kind of a story it is, who these characters are, who Job is, who this God is, in order to say what it is that happens at that moment. And for some, I'm sympathetic to the I take comfort in dust and ashes view, some kind of a sense that, oh, okay, I realize that I am but dust.
Yeah.
Not that I'm humiliated, not that I recant, not that I say I should not have demanded an accounting. In fact, that's what human beings do. Because Job also gets praised afterwards by God for speaking rightly.
Yeah.
So it's very strange. Job takes his words back, and then God says Job has spoken well.
But the words he says I wanted to talk about.
Yes,
sure if I've gotten it right completely, but in effect, he says, what are the times not kept by the Almighty? Is he calling out God? Is he mentioning that God is delinquent or God doesn't really care about the dealings of humankind in that way?
Along the way, he certainly does. So there are many places in the conversation, whatever it is, the shouting match between right. Job and his friends, in which Job says things that come so close to blasphemy that many people now think that actually Satan did win the bet that right. Job did curse God because he said, you know, he destroys the innocent with the wicked. He doesn't care, blah, 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 blah. That, in fact, he argues that God has no concern for human beings at all, that God is completely uninvested in justice or doesn't care about innocence. So all these things are words that come from Job's lips. And one of the interesting challenges for the interpreter is, okay, so Job said all those things. And then God talked about something completely different. And then Job said, okay, I'm going to say no more. And then God says to the friends, I'm angry at you because you spoke wrongly. You didn't speak rightly about me the way my servant Job did. So does that mean that Job's complaints are in fact speaking rightly about God? And here I personally find myself very drawn by a tradition of interpretation that's much more common in Jewish than in Christian circles that says, yes, that's the right way to talk about God. If God doesn't make sense to you, say so.
Right.
Don't paper things over. Don't pretend that you understand things because if there's a God, God knows that you don't understand it. So the only thing you do is perjure yourself in doing it. You also close off access to this transcendent God if there is one. But the last thing you should do if things don't make sense is to say, oh, they make sense. They make sense to me. I'm not going to ask any questions. That's in some sense abandoning your humanity.
So a Jewish sense of that would be that that's hubris. That is in its sense blasphemy to pretend you understand.
That's right.
Works.
Yeah, me and God. You know, I can't explain it to you, but yeah, we know what's going on. Yeah, that would be the worst hubris.
Yeah. I wanted to ask a little bit more about this Jewish reading of the story. Job, in most, we believe, is it sort of a non-Hebrew, which is interesting, because I guess for Jews, you have to figure out what's to be done with a figure like Job, if in fact that's the case.
Mm-hmm. So I was surprised over the course of researching this book to find that the book of Job that's so important in contemporary Judaism, I should say post-Holocaust, post-Shoah Judaism as I know it, doesn't seem to have been – I mean, and he was a very important figure for scholars who were very – there were many, many, many different commentaries written about the book of Job. And yet it didn't really find – his story didn't find its way into the ordinary life of Jewish communities the way it did to Christian communities. And there's a midrash which sort of explains it in an interesting way for me, which likens Job to somebody who's in a boat with a bunch of other people who starts drilling a hole underneath his bench. And the other people say, what are you doing? The boat's going to sink. And he says, this is no business of yours. This is just my bench. So there's a sense that, okay, so even if Job is asking questions that are legitimate, they are dangerous questions that might lead to the capsizing or the sinking of the entire community. Maybe these are questions that most of us ordinary people can't deal with. Mm-hmm. Maybe they have to be kept quarantined in a place where they are safely studied in the context of greater knowledge that most of us don't have.
This idea of community is one that seems to, at least that connection to community is something that seems appealing to you. Did I read that right?
Yes. Sometimes people tell me I'm a little bit too community focused, and someone said, isn't the book of Job ultimately about a man who is completely abandoned by community, who has to suffer all of his experiences entirely alone? And I take that point, but also, I mean, if you think about the Blake illustrations again, for example, one of the things that I found really helpful in thinking about the book of Job is if you're telling the story or illustrating it or acting it, you have to make all these decisions about who's on the stage or who's in your image at various points. And in Blake's illustrations of the book of Job, Job is never alone. And in various dramatizations like JB that we started with, Job is never alone. So we nowadays tend to think that Job is the quintessential human being alone in this terrifying encounter with this overwhelming God. But in fact, the story itself never suggests that he was on his own.
Yeah.
So he's surrounded by a community that fails him. But at the end, this community is restored. So it's not saying people can't be trusted, community is unnecessary, we are bad friends. Yes, we are bad friends. Community can't be trusted, and yet we do need each other. And Job's life is restored, beginning with the restoration of his friendships.
Mm. You write about the Holocaust survivor Elie Wiesel, his sort of spin, maybe that's too crass a word, but his look at the story of Job, which you say he said, you say that he saw a Job on every street of post-World War II Europe.
Yes, that was a phrase that haunted me, that haunts me still. The sense that the book of Job, one of the things that Elie Wiesel argues very powerfully and beautifully is that even if the book of Job, even if there was no Job, his suffering is real. And even if Job wasn't Jewish in the text, he becomes Jewish through Jewish suffering. That somehow or other it fills out, it's kind of like an outline of a life of suffering, and that this is colored in over history by the suffering of Jewish people. And so that by the time you come to the end of the Shoah, Job is a fully Jewish figure and every Jewish person who survived has become Job. Job is the outline into which they're the only way they can still make sense of themselves since everything else seems to have collapsed.
Mm. Mark Larimore is with us. His book is called The Book of Job, a biography. And we need to take another quick break. We'll come back for some final thoughts after a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KDWR. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the scholar Mark Larimore. We're talking about his book, The Book of Job, a biography. I wanted to ask you about something you've said, that in some ways the story is human's finest moment, but it's also bad news for human religion, this story. I wanted to get you to say a little bit more about that. Is it the fact that just the sort of inconvenient details of the story, that God is kind of tricked into this wager, that raises these really difficult questions for Orthodox believers?
It's a difficult where shall I start? It's a difficult text to fit into any theology.
Yeah.
There are bits of it that sort of harmonize with a whole bunch of different kinds of theologies. And while biblical scholars now, academic scholars would say, well, actually the reason it resonates with all these different ones and not really with itself, that it's sort of a jangling mess itself, is because it isn't supposed to make sense in its own terms. And if we can sort these things out and see where each of them is supposed to resonate, maybe we can bring some kind of order into our view. But the text itself messes all these things up again. It's the bull in the china shop.
Do you think it gives another sense of God? One that, I mean, that God doesn't have a reason that we can make sense of? Because, you know, people have always thought, for example, the Book of Job is about how just take your time and justice will eventually come. But in a sense, or this idea that the wicked, don't worry, the wicked eventually will be punished and the good will be rewarded. But that's not how the story works out. So maybe we're just reading it wrong.
Right. And that's what the friends say.
Yeah.
The friends say to Job, just wait. If you wait long enough and, you know, you must have done something. And if you didn't do something, you know, think of something and, you know, just say that you're sorry and then everything's going to be fine. So the one thing that does seem clear is that the friends get smacked down for that view. That's sort of a pat theology, which really is the way in which Job lives in many people's lives. It's that story. But the Book of Job is really not just about that. It's about something much, much more complicated, which might be that God is so mysterious to human beings that we can't even write a coherent story about God.
Is there any way of there's no way of knowing this, obviously, but I wonder if you've ever wondered if the story, the way this first developed, we talked about this idea that it was created as a parody. Is there any sense that whoever it is that first conceived of the story didn't believe in a God?
Certainly there are many people who read it that way, as kind of a vindication that the thinking person trying to think through what it is that this biblical tradition tells us and squaring and letting it, trying to square it with human experience, finds, well, they just don't fit. This is the theodicy, the problem of evil again. So certainly there are many people who see this as, in some strange way, monotheism or religion's confession that it actually can't make sense of human experience. Mm-hmm. And that all of its other efforts to say, oh, yes, all of this is obviously created and God looked at it and it was good and blah, 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 that somehow or other that doesn't quite, not just doesn't quite, doesn't even begin to make sense of the depths of human experience.
It's interesting that this idea of Christians really hear, you know, you hear the term the patience of Job. That doesn't come from Job. That comes from the New Testament. That comes from James, you point out.
Yes. I actually had a little bit of fun with that in the introduction, because it's now a fairly common thing to take those two parts of the Book of Job. We've been talking about the sort of the saccharine frame story and then the sort of strident poetic speeches in the middle and say, well, the story, it's two different characters. So the Job on the outside, who suffers for a long time and gets everything back, he's the patient Job. And the one in the middle is the impatient Job. But it strikes me that it's at least possible that whoever wrote the Epistle of James was referring to the whole book and saying the attitude that you see in the Book of Job, the person who persists through the end, whatever it takes without ever blaspheming, however close he comes, remaining, demanding a relationship with God, demanding some kind of an accounting, some kind of something, that actually is patience, that's actually what James was commending. He wasn't saying, sit quiet and everything will be fine. There are other people you could have pointed to, like Abraham.
Yeah. It's interesting. You say in the book that the Book of Job speaks to and for the broken. And I'd heard you talk about the story of I don't know if you were reading it with the Book of Job with or along with some homeless people. And I wonder if that gave you some insights or perspective on the story.
Very much so. Yes, this was a reading group at the Soup Kitchen of the Holy Apostles here in Chelsea in New York. And a number of Soup Kitchen guests came to the Bible study, and they instructed me about the Book of Job as well. I was presenting what it is that I'd come up with and said, scholars said this and this ancient person said that and blah, 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 blah. And they were very solicitous and they listened to me. And then at the point at which I said, a lot of people are unsatisfied with the ending because they think, you know, Job shouldn't have taken all this stuff back. I mean, that's one of the things that Elie Wiesel finds so troublesome for the first many decades of his engagement with the Book of Job. How could Job have let God get away with it? How could he have been allowed himself to be paid off at the end? And then they sort of smiled at me. And then one of these guys said, well, you know, he's going to lose it again anyway. And I said, what do you mean? He's like, well, all these things come and go.
Yeah.
You know, this isn't a one-time only thing. Our lives are full of things that come in and they all get lost and they get destroyed and something else will come along. So Job for them isn't a single story about a single test, but a sense, I mean, this really takes the persistence, patience thing to another level. It's kind of a persistence that keeps on going, even though, you know, that God can do this kind of thing and God does these sorts of things to people. You still persist.
Mm.
This was quite an amazing sort of lesson to me.
Yeah. Well, you write in the book that as we try and make sense of suffering continually, you know, the Book of Job continues to be invaluable, you say, to us. I wanted you to talk about that because you refer, for example, to the poet Nellie Sachs, who sees Job as like those direction markers on a compass. Talk about what you mean.
I think that, well, we haven't actually talked very much about what Job says. I mean, we've talked about the anger that he expresses, and he goes through many, many different stages of grief or torment or existential crisis or cognitive dissonance or however you want to put it. But in each of these cases, he sort of pushes language to the limit. And his friends try, more or less well-intentionedly, to sort of say, oh, what you mean is this, right? And each time he says, no, that's not what I mean at all.
Yeah.
So I think that Job gives voice to those people who language doesn't support them anymore. The explanations they grew up with, the ones that they share with the people they love, don't make sense of their experience at all. And so there's something about that. So that's the brokenness part. And then yeah. Job's language itself, he doesn't actually give us a new way to talk about these questions. He just gives us questions, protest, indignation, disbelief, anguish, self-recrimination, all kinds of things. But that's a whole different province of human expression. And my sense is that for people who grow up with the story of Job, if they find themselves in this moment where everything is broken down, including language, the figure of Job is still something they can cleave to. They can say what Job said.
Yeah.
Or even where Job was speaking from, that's where I am.
So that's what you mean when you write in the book that even in a world, as you say, disclosed by science, that this kind of story could be consoling.
In some strange way, it is. And in some way, I mean, I mentioned some people who say that's the most mysterious part of it. The most mysterious part might be that Job lives on, that Job is consoled.
Job may outlive his God, you say in the book.
Yes. certainly, I'm boring university professor guy, so we're like just reading the Book of Job among other books sitting around our seminar table. But I think the Book of Job feels so comfortable in the context of things that we read in a liberal arts college that whatever happens to religion, I think we'll keep wrestling with this book.
Mm. Mark Larimore.
Not that I think religion's going anywhere.
Right. Make that clear. Mark Larimore, he directs the Religious Studies program at the New School in New York City. His book is called The Book of Job, a biography. Joined us from New York. And Professor, thank you very much for the time.
My pleasure.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.